As the Israelites plan to enter the land, one point must be perfectly clear. It is the same point that we need to understand as we pursue victorious Christian living. Joshua chapters 3 and 4 will not give us one of many ways to experience victory in Christian living. It will give us the only way to experience victory in our Christian pursuit. And it is important for us, as it was for them then, to note not only what God did, but why God would do it, and what it took on their part to see it happen. Now, if you were with us in our last session, you remember the spies returned from Jericho with the report that all of the peoples were terrified at their coming. And so at their report, the people of Israel gather all of their things and they travel the 7 or 8 miles to the edge of the swirling Jordan River, and there they camp for 3 or 4 days. And as the day of the crossing approaches, Joshua, unlike most military leaders, says to the people, not sharpen your swords and polish your shields, but he says, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow you will see the hand of the Lord. Look at chapter 3, verse 4, and take a look at what he said. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. You see, there is this path of victory that makes important the purity of man and the power of God. So he says to consecrate themselves. What is consecration? Well, back then it meant several things. It meant washing their clothes. It meant taking a physical bath. It also meant a time of confession. It was a time of personal searching. This consecration was something taken very seriously by an Israelite. And Joshua tells them, I want all of you to consecrate yourselves. Why? Because for God's power to be revealed, his people must be pure. Perhaps the reasons that we do not see God's power as much as we do is because we have fallen in our part to present to him pure vessels. But why all of the bother now of consecration? In addition to that, it is critical that Israel recognize not only that God's power will pull back the Jordan waters, but they must be consecrated so that they can sense all of the value of that miracle. You see, ladies and gentlemen, it is possible for you and I to experience the power of God. It is possible for us to see God's hand at work and notice, but never connect, never sense the value. You see, the Israelites needed to understand when they saw the Jordan waters go back that if God is powerful to do that, then something else will happen. He is powerful enough to dispel the attack of the Amorite. If God can pull back these raging waters, he is powerful enough to help them overcome the Girgashite warrior who lives to fight. It is important that they notice that if God is powerful to help them enter the land, he is powerful enough to give them the land. An unconsecrated heart in life, in effect, ladies and gentlemen, blinds our eyes. Does it bother you that you could possibly go through life and God could be at work and you never really recognize all that's happening? Does it bother you that God could work in the routine affairs of your life and you completely miss it? Because there's the lack of consecration in our hearts. Joshua announces to the people, not sharpen your swords there in that chapter. He says, consecrate yourselves, for the Lord will do wonders among you tomorrow. The point is, God does not need clever people to conquer Canaan. He needs clean people through whom he can conquer Canaan. Now, the difficulty facing these people is this swirling Jordan River. The word Jordan literally means descender, because it would descend 1,000 feet as it makes its way from the Sea of Galilee down to the Arabah Sea, or the Salt Sea. We know it today as the Dead Sea. And that descent of 1,000 feet causes a natural current, not a torrent, but it's a current. However, during the flood season, that is, during their harvest time, it would overflow its banks and fill what we call the Jordan floodplain. Now, the floodplain was anywhere from 1 mile to 3 miles wide. And every year, the Jordan would overflow its banks and cover a period of perhaps as much as a mile in width. Now, the text tells us that that is the exact point that the Israelites are standing on the edge. It is when it's at flood season. It's overflowing its banks. So they're looking not at a little current or a stream with a good run and a jump, they'll make it. They're looking at a mile, perhaps, wide torrent of rushing water. Humanly speaking, there was no possible way for the children of Israel to cross over it. It was, to them, the major obstacle. It was an impossibility. And adding to that suspense is that little phrase in verse 4. Look at chapter 3 again, verse 4. There's a volume in that. For you have not passed this way before. And I love that. You see, this generation, apart from Joshua and Caleb, had not seen God part the waters of the Red Sea. They didn't have any experience to pull from. Say, oh, I've seen him do that before. I know he can do it now. These people, I am sure, were standing there wondering, God, you want us in the land, but now we've got this problem in our way, and it's about a mile wide, and it's very deep. And I'm not sure we're very good swimmers. And I know my children aren't, and our cattle, and all of our belongings. So there was a significant problem. And I think that's why we need to understand the significance of the Ark of the Covenant. Look at chapter 3, verse 6. Joshua spoke to the priests, saying, take up the Ark of the Covenant and cross over ahead of the people. So they took up the Ark and went ahead of the people. That is, these priests got in the front of the line. Then Joshua said to the sons of Israel, come here and hear the words of the Lord your God. Joshua said, by this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will assuredly dispossess from before you the Canaanite, and the Hittite, the Hivite, the Perizzite, the Girgashite, the Amorite, the Jebusite, and all the other parasites. Verse 11. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all of the earth is crossing over ahead of you. That is, it's leading the way into the Jordan. Now then, take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man for each tribe, and we'll know why in a moment. Verse 13, and it shall come about when the soles of the feet of the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all of the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, and the waters which are flowing down from above shall stand in one heap. So it came about when the people set out from their tents to cross the Jordan, there were the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant before the people. Now let's stop there just for a moment. This ark was a 2x4 foot box. Rather simple. It was overladen with gold, which made it very beautiful. But inside the ark, there were several important things. There was the rod of Aaron, which supernaturally budded to life. There was a jar of manna that was a constant reminder of God's provision when they didn't have anything. And there were also in there the tablets of stone with which God, who with his own hand, wrote the commandments. You remember the first set was crashed to the ground by an angry Moses. Well, the next time around, God wrote it with his own finger, emblazoning into that stone the commandments. And those stone tablets were inside the ark as well. Now, the lid was, of course, gold, and on top of the lid were two angels, or cherubim, and they were facing each other with their wings spread out or toward them, covering their faces. Now, they believed then that the power of God, or literally the presence of God, rested in the cradle of the wings of these angels. Not like, you know, these popular movies which have him in the box. He is there, as it were, in the crest of their wings. And so the point is, the ark is supposed to lead the way. What did that mean? That meant that they were not just the people going for a trek or a camping journey into this land to see if they kind of liked it there, and they were optimistic and hoping the people would open their arms up and say, oh, the Israelites, welcome. No, they were people of God being led by God. And with God in front leading the way, they by faith were to follow. Now that's where the challenge comes in. You notice as I read that it talked about the priests. When would God part the waters? When the priests dipped their feet into the water. Now, I wouldn't have wanted to be a priest in that day, but if I were, I'm sure all of those priests are carrying the ark and they're heading toward the water's edge, and all the while they're probably saying in Hebrew, Lord, help me, please. Or we're sunk. Why did God wait until, as it were, the midnight hour? Why not the night before? Just roll back the waters, blow the moisture out of the dirt, and so then when they get up in the morning, oh, great, let's get up, get our stuff, and go through. Why would he go through this? Why would the process be the priests must first put their foot in the water's edge, and then I'll act? Why is it that he waits so long for you in order to come through for you? Ever wonder why? I think there is a fundamental principle here, ladies and gentlemen, that as God leads us into the land of rest, the land of victory, He is much more interested in developing His people than He is in displaying His power. So we get all hung up on wanting His power, and now, but God wants to develop the faith of His people. And so he waited until the last moment. Now let's watch him work. Pick it up at verse 15 in chapter 3. And when those who carried the ark came into the Jordan, and the feet of the priests carrying the ark were dipped into the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflows all its banks all the days of harvest, that the waters which were flowing down from above stood and rose up in one heap, a great distance away at Adam, the city that is beside Zerath and toward the Sea of Araba, the Salt Sea, or the Dead Sea, were completely cut off. So the people crossed opposite Jericho, verse 17. And the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan, while all Israel crossed on dry ground until all the nation had finished crossing the Jordan. The waters now piled up as far as 30 miles, the city of Adam. And why would God do that? I think because this mountain of water would be a testimony to His power, but it would also be a warning. My people are coming. And another opportunity to repent, to throw down their arms, they would see Him coming. Now, I have read a number of books, and in my library I have books written by people of liberal persuasion, more than that liberal persuasion, those of conservative persuasion. And it has been a real interesting thing and almost laughable to read those liberal commentators as they try to dance their way around these miraculous events. Ladies and gentlemen, it cannot be done if you take this at face value. Let me give you the sequence of all of the miracles involved here. Number one, the waters were at flood stage. Number two, the waters were stopped just as promised. Chapter 3, verse 16. Verses 15 and 16 tell us, third, that the timing was exact. It was right when the feet of the priests hit the water. Now, I read one gentleman who suggested that there was an earthquake uphill somewhere, and the land caved in and stopped the water. And isn't that amazing? It had happened right then, and they were able to clear it out right when the priests got out of the water. That takes an awful lot more faith, I think, than to believe that God did this. But at any rate, the wall of water was held in place while the entire nation crossed, verse 17. Could have been as long as a day. More than 2 million people are crossing. Then there's another in verse 17. The soft river bottom became dry at once. You have to cut that word out of your Bible or you're going to have to believe it. It became dry like that. And then finally, the waters returned immediately as soon as the crossing was completed. Chapter 4, verse 18. Now, one incident takes place here in chapter 4 that I want to spend the remainder of our time on. It takes place in chapter 4, verse 2. Look at that. Take for yourselves 12 men from the people, one man from each tribe, and command them, saying, take up for yourselves 12 stones from here out of the middle of the Jordan, from the place where the priests' feet are standing firm, and carry them over with you and lay them down in the lodging place where you will lodge tonight. Skip over to verse 19. Now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th of the first month, and they camped, this is their first camping site, at Gilgal, on the eastern edge of Jericho. Verse 20. And those 12 stones which they had taken from the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. Men and women, it is critically important that we prepare to see God work, that we consecrate our lives, that there is purity on our part, confession of sin, so that the hand of God can work. And it is also important that by preparing, we are able to see Him work, that we can put the facts together. We can see His power and His presence, and that is a wonderful thing to be able to observe. But it is just as critical as those other two as to remember that God did work. Perhaps one of the greatest enemies to the victorious Christian life is forgetfulness. Just as in marriage, the greatest threat is not something that can happen overnight. The greatest threat is the constant erosion of forgetting the significance of the vow. One of the greatest threats to the Christian life is walking through life and never pausing, never stopping to take note that God has worked all of us have experienced, I know, the point in our lives when we have wondered, is he really at work? And the only reason we say that is because we've forgotten that he already has. As one man wrote, the superstructure of our lives are built upon the foundation of our memories. We are instructed by our memories as how to live now. Another one writes that memories of God's hand and power create the soil in which our present roots of faith sink deeply and from which we receive nourishment. Now, God's direction was very clear to Joshua. Look back at verse 21 of chapter 4. Joshua would then repeat the message. He said to the sons of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, what are these stones? Then you shall inform your children, saying, Israel crossed this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed, just as the Lord your God had done to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed. So the people set up then a memorial of stones. Why is it so important? Well, let me suggest not only that, which I've already suggested, but add to that. Memorial stones are incredibly important for several reasons. Number one, memorial stones help us to overcome the tendency to forget. I can be so preoccupied with my immediate problem and the supposed lack of spiritual resources that I overlook by forgetting that God had already provided, or in the past, he has provided the resources necessary. That's because by nature, we tend to remember the negative. We catalog the defeats and bump us, and we can spit them out. We've alphabetized them in our memory. We know they're there, and because they are so constantly in our conscious mind, we whenever we face trouble, what do we run to first? Failures, defeats. And as a result, we continue propagating the defeated life. But there's another reason memorial stones are important, and that is this. Secondly, they remind us of the importance of thanksgiving. God would provide a number of times in impossible situations. Perhaps you are right in the middle of an impossible situation. I don't know what it is, but you do. That monument from the past impossibility allows you the opportunity to stop and thank God for what he has done. Because so often we can get caught up in asking him to do something now that we forget to praise him for what he did then. The third that I would suggest to you is very clear here, and that is so the people would be challenged to share the story with the next generation. Several years later, there at Gilgal National Park, there's a heap of 12 stones. And there's an Israelite father with his 6, 7, 8-year-old, maybe teenage son or daughter. And the child says, Daddy, what do these stones mean? What are they here for? The father or the mother can say, well, why don't we pull up a seat right here? Let me tell you what happened. This is where God came through with tremendous power so that you and I can enjoy everything that we have today. What will the children or the next generation hear from us? Will they hear that God is worth following? That God is powerful? Will they hear that God can be trusted? Or will all they hear from us is a recollection of defeat, despair, discouragement? Whether you are here with little children or grown children or a grandparent here with grandchildren, you have a tremendous opportunity to give to the next generation the message that God is alive and that he works and that he's powerful and that he can be trusted. Now I want to go one more step here in terms of practicality, because I think we all have the same problem of forgetfulness. And I want to suggest to you that we begin to build what we'll call a trophy room. And we will put in it the mementos of God's power and his presence. It may be a journal where you write things down. It might be a computer disk where you have a file that you activate whenever you want to make another entry. It could be putting things to song. It could be including them in your personal prayer life or whatever it may be. But building a trophy room to fill with the power and providences of God. And let me suggest, by way, some entries that you would make. Number one, let me make this very clear. Refuse, first of all, any entry of spiritual defeat or failure. Why? Because we want to ignore them? Oh, no. The trouble isn't that we're ignoring them. The trouble is we can't forget them. They will always be there. You don't need to write these down. Okay? This will be a trophy room, not a boxing ring where the good will fight the bad. This is a place where you will remember what God has done. So refuse, right off the bat, putting down anything of that nature. Second of all, I want to suggest that you revisit places of spiritual significance. Maybe in your mind, you go back and down memory lane and you remember that particular place of great significance. Perhaps that church where you trusted Christ, the campus dormitory room where you were discipled, a place where you met an individual who impacted you, as we'll talk about in a moment. But revisit them. Go back if you physically can, especially if you are here and you are saying things like, God is not at work in my life. You have forgotten that He is. And you have forgotten that He has been. Let me suggest, secondly, that you remember people who made a spiritual impact on your life. For you, there may be people in your life right now. For me, a wife and children impact me daily to live as I ought to live. I can add to that list a parent, both parents. I can add a brother who's in the ministry. I can jot down into that journal some college professors and a few seminary profs and people in this church that have impacted me in a spiritual way. And let me suggest that once you've come up with those names, that you call them up. Now be prepared for a heart attack on their end, because they probably don't have any idea that they impacted you. Spiritual people don't recognize that. But you tell them what they did for you. Maybe call them on the phone. But jot into your journal not just events, not just places, but people. And the next time that you mope around and you say, God doesn't care about me, He's not at work in my life, then you can stop and hit yourself with the question, then if that's true, why in the world did He spend so much creative design to bring these people into your life at different crossroads? And then you might wake up and say, well, wow, you know, He has worked. I'm just ignoring His work now, unable to see it because of the valley. Rekindle moments of spiritual decision. You remember that time you raised your hand or you knelt at an altar? Perhaps wrote a letter. Perhaps that point in time when you said yes to God. Perhaps the time when you committed your marriage or your home or your career to God. Go back and rekindle those moments of spiritual decision. A couple of years ago, I did something of going back to the home where I was raised. My parents lived in the same home for 19 years. And my brothers and I were raised there, and they moved when I went to college. But there was a very special place in that house. And God motivated me, I believe, to go back and just rekindle that particular moment. So I remember getting in the car. We were home visiting my folks, and I got in the car and headed to the house about 45 minutes away. And pulled up outside. And, of course, if you've ever been back to a place like that, you notice how different it looks than what your memory has. That front yard was so tiny. And a touchdown seemed so long back then, but now it was just a little patch. And it was also growing grass, which was a miracle. It never did when we were growing up. But I went up and knocked on the door, and this gal answered the door, 20, 21 years of age, carrying a baby on her hip. And I kind of awkwardly said, I'd like to come in and look around. This is where I was raised. And she said, well, far out, man. Come on in. And I became a little nervous about what my room looked like at that particular point. But I looked around, and everything was much smaller, of course, than I remembered, and went up the stairs and turned left and walked into what was my room, kind of a glorified closet, a 5x7, a little rug and a little bed, and it was pretty much the same. And I walked into that room, and I wanted to go in there for one reason only, and I stood right there, where as an 18-year-old, I knelt one night and I said to God, Lord, I'm making a decision to give You my life now. And I stood there until she got nervous and wondered, you know, what I was doing. And I explained to her and eventually left. Boy, that did a lot for me. I would suggest you do the same if you can. If you can't physically go, at least remember those places of spiritual decision, those people who impacted you spiritually, those decisions that you made. that impacted your life. Let me suggest one more. That you record the moments of spiritual victory. You remember that time God answered that prayer? Well, more than likely, you, like me, forgot what we prayed about last month, and it probably came to pass. But at the particular time when it came to pass, it may strike us as insignificant or small, but write it down then. Perhaps the time when a loved one came to Jesus Christ that you had been praying for so long, or the time when financial relief came from nowhere. Those times when God came through in a very visible, prominent way, record them. You remember in the darkness of that valley you were in when God gave you special verses? Have you ever gone back and read those verses again? By nature, we remember the valley. We remember the darkness of the night. And because of that, the pain, the disappointment, the despair is so fresh. Combat them with fresher memories of God's providence. I kind of like to imagine that King David had a trophy room. Probably because he was a man, and men are pretty bad about keeping things like that. Some of you guys got 20-year-old bowling trophies stuck somewhere you wouldn't dare throw away. I would imagine that David had a room like that, and I've imagined what it must have looked like. And I visited it in my memory. I could remember keeping special things for myself. I would just bet that David kept some things. Perhaps it's a room of stone walls and a fireplace. And you look at the fireplace and you're struck right away with the fact that lying in front of it is a bearskin rug, the one David killed. And maybe mounted on the fireplace is the stuffed head of a lion, the one he killed as a boy. I think the gravitating thing of the room, had he kept one, would have been one particular wall, and mounted on it would be this huge display of armor, a Philistine helmet that he had recovered when the army fled, a large breastplate of bronze, and a huge spear with a bronze head, a long sword, armor belonging to Goliath. I imagine one of the most prized possessions would have been hanging perhaps on the mantle from a peg, a well-worn fabric cord with a leather pouch sewn in the middle, his old sling. Maybe tucked away on a shelf somewhere is a little piece of cloth, the cloth he cut from Saul's robe, a tremendous display of God's grace in his life. Rather than plunging his spear into his body, his enemy, he cut a piece from his robe to let him know he'd been there. Maybe he kept that too. Where do you keep your memories of God's power? Do you pray them back to God? Do you record them in a journal? Do you type them? Do you sing them? Or do you forget them? It was so significant to God that they remember this miracle that God said, I want you to take 12 ordinary stones. And by the way, there is principle in that. Memorials don't need to be dazzling. They don't need to be sensational to be significant. Just a pile of stones. To the world, your prayers answered would be probably simple. The way that God came through in your life, maybe it wouldn't put any sizzle into a public church meeting, or it really wouldn't hit the vine. Hey, have you heard what God did? Maybe nobody else would care, but between you and God, they are priceless. Do you have some way of remembering them? Perhaps it's time to start. So that just as Joshua chapter 4 ends, we would be able to say, in the valley, in the time of difficulty, by looking at our trophies, that we may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, so that we may trust the Lord our God forever.